It's not, I never reached a point in my life where I could prove that God exists or that, you know, Jesus is God and all the rest of it. But I got to the point where the evidence was just so compelling. It almost required a certain stubbornness or a certain agenda not to kind of surrender to the implications of the scientific evidence. And so as a Christian and as a scientist, you know, I see as a scientist, I would say, okay, there's an external source of information. Leave it at that. Don't name it. Don't spin it. Don't embellish on it. It's an external source of information. I'll leave it to you to figure out what that is. As a Christian, I believe, obviously, that's God. That's the creator of the universe. He's not within the universe. He is external to the universe. He created time and space and gravity.
Dr. Michael Guillen, thanks for joining me on the podcast today.
Les, thank you for inviting me. Looking forward to our discussion.
Yeah, it seems like there's a bunch of things you're into that I'm also curious about and would like to talk about, but I know you have a documentary that by the time this is being published, will probably already be out, Invisible Everywhere, Believing is Seeing. So I thought maybe we could start with what that's about and why it was important for you to make this documentary.
Yeah, I'd be happy to. It premieres worldwide April 8th. Just go to the Invisible Everywhere .com. I've made a movie in the past, Les, and kind of went the traditional route, theaters, Walmart, Netflix. Now it's on Amazon and Apple TV and Stars, and it's distributed by Lionsgate, you know, yada, yada, yada. And that movie is called Little Red Wagon. I'm very proud of it. It's an award-winning movie. But this time around, I made the movie in a very unconventional way using AI tools on my laptop computer. If you can imagine, in this room that I'm in right now, I made this movie all by myself using AI tools. That's crazy. But it really goes back to a book that I published almost 5 years ago called Believing is Seeing, How Science, a Physicist Explains. It's got a long subtitle. It's like, I guess, long subtitles are in. That's what the publisher tells me. But The subtitle is, A Physicist Explains How Science Shattered His Atheism and Revealed the Necessity of Faith. It's like War and Peace. It's like, anyway, but seriously, it's all about my journey from atheism to believing in God and how it was science that really converted me, converted my worldview. I fell in love, my short story is that I fell in love with science in the second grade. I was born in Los Angeles, East Los Angeles. Fell in love with science in the second grade. I have clear recollections of it. And my teacher was Miss Cook. Those were the days before Ms. and Mrs. So I don't really know if she was a Miss Cook or a Mrs. Cook, but it was a cook. I thought that, you know, at that age, I thought, well, any self-respecting would-be scientist ought to live by really kind of hardcore mottos. So I had like three mottos that I adopted for myself. Number one was seeing is believing. If I can't see it, I'm not going to believe it. Prove it. If I can't prove something or if you can't prove something to me, I'm not going to believe it. And then the third one, I was just so enamored of science. It was like my God. It was my everything, actually. I thought science would be able to answer all my questions given enough time. And it wasn't until I got to grad school at Cornell, where I got my PhD in physics, math, and astronomy years later, I was kind of a young 20-something, I discovered I was wrong on all counts. And we can dive more deeply into that. But the point is that because I had this kind of seismic awakening, this kind of unexpected turn of events in my life, I embarked on really a kind of spiritual journey, but I was still a scientist, so it turned into kind of, instead of just a scientific journey, turned into a scientific and spiritual journey. It was new for me. I'd never took religion very seriously. God was never on my radar because I can't see him and I can't prove him. So, you know, why would I believe in a God? And that spiritual journey began, one of my professors, Carl Sagan, he was a very famous astronomer. He was getting to be famous at that time. And he was on the Johnny Carson show, the Tonight Show. He did Cosmos and the whole night. And I was there. I mean, it was just dumb luck. I just happened
to be. I loved Cosmos.
Yeah.
I loved it as a kid.
Yeah. Well, if you loved Cosmos, you're going to love my movie, The Invisible Everywhere. I think Carl would like it. But anyway, Like I said, he was one of my astronomy professors, along with Frank Drake, and the pair of them, Frank and Carl, of course, are the founders of SETI, the Search for Extraterrestrial Intelligence. So I just, again, happened to luck out that I was in the right place at the right time, and I had a front row seat to the making of Cosmos. I actually got to know the executive producer, Adrian Malone. He was a very kind of fiery British guy, and he ended up actually locking horns with Carl, but that's a whole nother podcast, Les. We won't get into that. But the reason I'm telling you this is because every time, and I think Carl was an unbelieving Jew. He was just a cultural Jew, a secular Jew. I don't think you would call him a hardcore atheist. I think he was more open-minded than that, but definitely an agnostic. But every time he would be interviewed by reporters about his religious beliefs, his worldview, he would refer to the Vedas, and I knew nothing about the Vedas. And this was the days before Google, so I couldn't just like go online, Google it. I had to go to Olin Library, had to trudge all the way to Olin Library, which is the grad student library at Cornell, go up into the stacks in search of the Vedas, and lo and behold, I discovered that they are the sacred religion of the Hindu religion. And I just immersed myself in it. I thought it was fascinating. I was like a kid in a candy shop. I'd never, ever bothered to look into the spiritual world. It was always, for me, the materialistic world. It was that fully satisfied me. So then, while I was doing that, I encountered Hermann Hesse, who is a Nobel Prize-winning German novelist, and he wrote books about, primarily about tormented intellectuals in search of answers to their deep questions about life. And I thought, well, that's me. I'm a tormented intellectual in search of answers to my deep questions in life. And so I fell in love with Hermann Hesse. I read Siddhartha and Beneath the Wheel and Narcissus and Goldmoon and all the rest of them. And I just loved it. It was so romantic. I pictured myself, you know, wearing sandals and a robe and just trudging along this journey called, you know, life, search of deep answers to my deep questions. Anyway, so that's what my book, And Believing is Seeing, is all about. I then explored, a friend of mine gave me a copy of the I Ching, and I got into that, and I got Islam, and my thesis advisor was Jewish, so he would take me to Shabbat services on Friday night, and I immersed myself in Judaism, and transcendental meditation was always a big deal back then. A guru, I think it was Maharishi Mahesh Yogi, was making the rounds of the college campuses back then. So I attended his seminars, and what attracted me as a scientist, kind of on this weird spiritual journey, it wasn't weird, it was actually fascinating. I was fascinated by it. I was just enraptured by it. He said, if you become a devotee of TMI, Transcendental Meditation International, you can levitate, you can actually defy gravity. And for a nerd like me, I'm thinking, wow, I can defy gravity? That's pretty cool if I could do that. So I got into that for a while. And then it wasn't until later that co-ed...
Did you ever levitate?
No, I tried. I saw pictures of people levitating. I'm thinking, man, okay, this seems like the real deal. I mean, I literally, but they were always against a wall. That should have made me a little bit suspicious. Although now in the days of photoshopping, you could probably show somebody levitating and, you know, in the middle of a cornfield or something. I remember, and you have to understand, throughout all of this, I was a scientific monk. I mean, science was still my God, even though I was on this romantic spiritual journey. I call it my Hermann Hesse-like journey. But I was still, above all and primarily, a scientific monk. So, you know, I would spend 20 hours in the lab. It was a basement lab, no windows, couldn't tell if it was day or night, didn't really care, had no social life, didn't want a social life. Barely groomed myself, barely ate. I mean, you get the picture. And it was one evening I was coming home from the lab. It was about 3 a.m, and I opened the door to my dorm room, tiniest dorm room in Sage Hall. I loved it. It was actually a converted janitor's closet, but I loved it because it was near the bathroom, so it was real convenient for me. I opened the door, and I hear a scraping sound, and I look down, and there's a white envelope with my name on it. A really odd experience for me. And I opened it, and it was a Valentine's Day card. From this gal who I had taught 2 years earlier, a physics class. And one thing led to another, and we started, you know, spending some time together. And I remember she was a lapsed Catholic from New York, Long Island. And she said to me, you know, you seem to be like searching for answers to your deep questions. You know, you've immersed yourself in all these other religions. She says, let me ask you, have you ever read the Bible? And, you know, my reaction was immediate because I said, well, no, for two reasons. Number one, I grew up in L.A. and I heard about the Bible, my family, and, you know, it's just too familiar for me to think that there's anything in there that would interest me. It, you know, sometimes familiarity breeds contempt, as the old saying goes, right? So it was just familiar.
We like novelty.
Yeah.
Humans like novelty, for sure.
They do. They do. I was enamored studying about all these incredible religions. And then I said, and second of all, you know, it's my impression that, you know, people who read the Bible, Christians, they hate science. You know, they have a grudge against science, and science is my number one love, so why would I read the Bible? And then she said something less that actually changed my life forever. And she said, well, I haven't read the Bible either, but if you read it, I'll read it with you. And I did a quick calculation, you know. It was easier than calculus, actually. And I'm like, okay, well, if I can spend a little more time with this pretty sorority girl, she was from Kappa Kappa Gamma, I don't really care about the Bible, but she's making an offer that I can't refuse. So I said, yeah, let's do it. And ended up that, you know, we're both kind of overachiever intellectuals, so it took us like 2 years to schlep through the whole Bible from beginning to end. We asked so many questions, and we like, oh, didn't that contradict what we read about like 2 days ago? And I finally told Laurel, I said, and I ended up marrying her, by the way, 34 years of marriage. But I said to her at one point, and we were just young 20-somethings at that point, discussing it over bagels at the college bagel shop, you know, and I would say, we're never going to get through this book, Laurel, at this rate. I said, let's get a spiral-bound notebook and write down our questions. And then we can come back and revisit all the questions and all the apparent contradictions, etc. 2 years less. 2 years. What struck me about that, the Old Testament didn't do much for me. I was like, okay, well, this is just another kind of logical religion telling me to hate my enemies, an eye for an eye, you know, blah, blah, blah. But when I got to the New Testament, it was like, I'll never forget it. It was an interesting thing. It was like, this character Jesus is talking in what I call a translogical way. It's very illogical. The first shall be last. You should love your enemies. You know, you have to die in order to really live, and on and on and on. And it was like, I've never heard, Buddha didn't talk that way. No religious figure that I had studied or immersed myself in spoke that way. And so it caught my attention because it resembled what I was studying in quantum mechanics. Quantum mechanics is also translogical. It doesn't make sense. And we can get into that if you want.
At the Mindful Movement Podcast, we talk a lot about the small shifts that make a big difference. And lighting? It's one of the most overlooked pieces of your well-being. That's why we're excited to share Chromalux light bulbs from healthlighting.com. These aren't your average light bulbs. Chromalux lights are designed to support your natural rhythms, reducing unnatural light spectrums and supporting a more balanced environment that feels better for your eyes and your mind. The difference is not just seen, but felt. Whether you're curating your workspace, winding down in the evening, or just trying to make your home feel a little more peaceful, the right light matters. Sarah and I have been steadily making the switch throughout our home, and its impact really makes a difference. It's honestly kind of hard to explain, but the space has become noticeably more inviting. If you're ready to bring more intention into your environment, head to healthlighting.com and explore Chromalux bulbs. And as a part of our Mindful community, you can get a special discount. Just use code MINDFULMOVEMENT at checkout. Light your space, support your mind, and keep on moving. If you've been listening to this podcast for a while, you've probably heard me talk about how important it is to regulate your nervous system. This goes for healing, for focus, for just overall emotional well-being. But the reality is that even if we know the tools to help do this, whether it's breathing or meditation or just slowing down, it can still be really hard to stay regulated throughout a busy day. That's one reason I've really been interested in the Apollo Wearable by Apollo Neuro. Sarah and I both use this device regularly and have found it very beneficial. It's a small wearable device that uses gentle vibrations, and they're designed to signal safety to your nervous system. What's fascinating is that those signals can help your body shift out of a stress state and into a calmer, more regulated state. What I like about it, most of all, is that even though it can work great alongside practices like meditation or breath work, the real value is that you can wear it throughout your day, even while you're at work, and just let it work its magic on your nervous system. The other standout use that I rely on is wearing it to bed. Not only does it help me fall asleep fast, but I often wake up around 3 a.m. and I can just tap the button on it and it will help lull me back to sleep quickly. If you want to learn more, check out the podcast episode with the founder, David Rabin, and you could explore more about the technology itself. But if you're someone that struggles with anxiety or feeling wired or overwhelmed, or you're simply looking for more nervous system support in daily life, it might be something worth exploring. You can learn more about the Apollo wearable and how it works and save $99 on a new device at apolloneuro.com/mindful or click the link in the show notes. I promise you won't regret this investment. I truly believe it's the best bang for the buck in the wellness tech space.
But
it just doesn't make sense based on our perception now with the tools we have.
Thank you. Exactly. Thank you. Absolutely. And when I say it doesn't make sense, it's not logical. It's what I call translogical. And so I was thinking, wow, Jesus is speaking the language of quantum mechanics. That's intriguing to me. Just purely as an intellectual, never mind the religious aspect to it. I mean, purely as an intellectual, I reacted to that. Now, I didn't fall on my knees and, you know, say, praise Jesus, I'm a Christian. No, because I'm a very hard-headed intellectual. And so it really wasn't until I was in my 40s, so maybe two decades later, that I had certain experiences and I had already been diving into Christianity more because it did strike me as a horse of a different color. And so it was like in my 40s when I decided, you know, this makes a whole lot of sense. And of all the religions that I've studied, it resonates most of all with my science, my beautiful, beloved science. Now, I say that without disparaging any religion. I'm always very careful, even in my writing, very respectful of other people's religion. I learned a lot from every religion. I respect every single religion. Especially, I'm talking about the major religions, not the kooky ones, but I mean, talking about mainstream major religions. So here I am. And so I wrote the book about this journey of mine from atheism to believing in God and ultimately believing in Jesus and the Bible and the whole nine yards. A rather odd story. I mean, it's not how I would have seen my life going. I just loved science. And then as I was going around talking, people would come up to me afterwards and say, you know, I read the book. I love it. I'd love for my kid to read the book, but I don't know if they're going to read the book. Would you consider making it into a movie? So I filed that away, and, you know, I was busy doing other things, and I wrote a novel and so forth. But I ended up writing a script, and that's the result of the invisible. The result of that effort is The Invisible Everywhere, Believing is Seeing. It's really... Yeah, how science shattered my atheism and opened my eyes to the existence of God, flipped my motto from seeing is believing to believing is seeing, completely upended that motto. And so here I am talking with you, Les. I mean, that's kind of the long and the short of it. And I'm really excited. April 8th. The last thing I wanted to say is, traditionally, like I did with Little Red Wagon Theater, you know, streamer and all that, but I have a lot of followers internationally. I mean, Thailand, South Africa, Australia, Great Britain, France, Morocco, Poland, I mean, Hungary, you name it. I have followers all over the world. And so they would ask me, they heard that I had made this movie, and they're, well, where can we see it? And I'm thinking, you know, when you distribute a movie in the traditional way, usually you open it up in the United States and then maybe you go overseas. But what are the odds it's ever going to get to Thailand? So, you know, at a local theater near, you know, Thailand, no, it ain't going to happen. So I decided to go, just as I did the movie in a weird kind of very innovative way, we're distributing it in an innovative way. All you have to do, come April 8th, whoever you are, wherever you are, whatever you believe, whatever you don't believe, just go to theinvisibleeverywhere.com www.theblackhawkmovie.com, and you can watch the movie. You can rent it, you can buy it, you can get it with behind-the-scenes stuff. There's even going to be an option where if you want to host a screening, you can do that as well. So it's there for the world to see. Right now, you can go see the trailer. But come April 8th, you're going to be able to see the entire movie. So anyway, that's the long and the short of it, Les.
Okay. So it's all basically from the website. That's interesting. I guess, you know, that's a sign of the times.
Yeah, it is. It's an online box office. And when you go there, you'll see it's a very elegant box office. And it's all there for, again, it's open to everybody all over the world. It is a sign of the times. Why do I want to do a four-wall theater where, you know, you have to check, where's my local theater? What are the show times? Can I make it? Maybe I can't make it. Maybe it's only playing for 2 weeks.
Well, I assume the barrier of entry cost-wise is, you know, way higher.
Oh, yeah. Let me tell you, the theaters, that's another, I mean, I didn't think of that when I made this decision. I just really want to be innovative from beginning to end. It's really it's a glimpse into the future of filmmaking and film distribution. But you're right.
It is pretty wild that you can make a whole full-length movie from your computer, from your house, by yourself.
Right,
it
here.
Is crazy. I mean, I think we're about to see so much crazy stuff unfold and so much wild content to take in, and a lot of it will probably be very uninteresting and garbage, and some of it will probably be exceptional. And I'm looking forward to seeing how, you know, hopefully the way humans harness these AI systems will enhance our life. I'm sure there's going to be all kinds of costs, but hopefully there's a net gain over time. And I'm excited to see it all unfold, even though there's part of me that is kind of, I don't know if it's like a romantic side or a stubborn old man side that just has one foot rooted in what I remember before all this stuff. And I don't want to change. And also it's like, well, change is coming. So how do you want to be about it? Do you want to be open to it? And, be able to enjoy the experience of life, or do you want to just hate on everything? You know, it's interesting. The story that you talk about coming from such a scientific background, I feel like I have heard before. Like, I also have spent a good amount of time learning about different, like, spiritual ideas. And also, I also was, like, kind of in love with science as a kid. And it was one of the few things in school that I actually, like, excelled at and was naturally curious. But one thing, I have heard this story before where, especially, like, physicists, where, you know, the science is their religion until it isn't, where they keep digging, and then they hit something that doesn't make sense. Like, maybe it's the, you know, a wave behaves like a wave till you observe it and it collapses to a particle. And it's like, oh, well, you need an intelligent observer to change the behavior of the matter, the reality. So where does the intelligence come from? And then they hit this, like, dead end. They hit this wall that their science can no longer answer. Yeah. And some of them just flip and be like, well, that must be a God then. It must be God providing the intelligence to allow that. Or, you know, the whole, like, well, what happened before the Big Bang? I mean, there's, like, the Big Bang is some pitch they want to sell. You know, everything came from nothing for no reason or whatever, and can't explain what happened before. Like, that's an obvious question mark that just gets, like, assumed as some underlying truth, but we don't really know. So it's interesting. Like, it's not that uncommon for people that are really into science, because they're so into science and they make these assumptions, that their world gets rocked when they hit a dead end and they flip sides.
The word rocked is perfect, Les. In fact, that's what happened to me, and you'll see that in the movie. But there years ago, and I'm trying to remember the name of the cartoonist, but Sidney Harris. I think Sidney Harris, if you Google it, he's famous for these kind of sketched out cartoon type, whatever you call them, editorial cartoons or whatever. But he specialized in science themes, right? Sidney Harris. I'm pretty sure that's true. And there was one actually that was my favorite. I actually had it hanging in my office at Cornell. It shows these two little kind of scruffy figures, like two little scientist types, right? And they're at a blackboard, And the blackboard is scrawled with all these equations. And if you can read it from left to right, there's equations, 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 and then there's like this big arrow that says a miracle happens, and then there's the result.
Right.
And the one little pudgy guy says to the other, he says, I think you need to be a little more explicit there in that step. And I say that in all, I mean, I'm joking, but I'm also serious because you're right. I mean, what I discovered by the time I was a young man in my 20s at Cornell was that third motto of mine, that science would be able to answer all my questions, just didn't pan out. What happened was just the opposite, that for every question science was able to answer for me, it raised like 100 others. It's almost like a weed. You know, if you don't pull a weed out by the root, you pull it out and you think, oh, I got it. But then you come back a week or two later and another, like more weeds are there than ever before. And one example of that is, dark matter, let's say. I mean, I could pick so many, but let's just pick dark matter. I mean,
sure.
Here's a guy named Fritz Zwicky. He's an Austrian-American astronomer. He's minding his own business. He's looking at the galaxies. He's looking at what we call galaxy clusters. That is, you know, groups of galaxies that kind of revolve around themselves like a slow-going merry-go-round, right? So here's old Fritz. He's looking through his telescope. He's taking down the data. He's taking down the images, and he's studying the photo plates. Noticing how fast these suckers are spinning, And it blows his mind that these galaxy clusters are actually spinning faster than they ought to be. We have something called the virial theorem. And the virial theorem relates the matter of something, the mass of something, with how fast it should be spinning, right? So mass and spin are related. The more mass, the more spin. The less mass, the less spin. So good old Fritz is doing the old virial theorem on his galaxy clusters. And lo and behold, these things are spinning way faster than they should be. Why? In other words, there has to be more matter that I'm able to see. There has to be more mass there than my telescopes are revealing to me. And as hard as he peered through his telescope, he couldn't see anything. And so he came up with the name Dunkelmaterie, which is German for dark matter. He's like, there's something there that's causing the extra spin. I don't know what it is. But let's call it dark matter. So it's like a placeholder, or like you said, a question mark. Well, that was 1933.
We still don't know what it is.
Here we are, you and me talking in 2026, and we still can't answer Fritz.
But we're so arrogant, though, because we act like labeling it dark matter is the answer, and that, well, that's what it is. Like, there's a big assumption that first that you really, you know, without understanding what that is, where it came from, why it exists, like there's a lot to that story that you're just glossing over, essentially. And then we build more narratives on top of this really shaky foundation.
Well, I'll tell you, you're absolutely right. It's like as if, okay, Fritz kind of, he did his job. It's Dunkelmaterie, job done. No, you've just raised a huge question. Okay, you've answered one question. The galaxy clusters are spinning faster than they should be. That's an interesting data point. We didn't know that before. So you've answered a good question. You've told us how fast these things spin. But in answering that question, you have now raised a much bigger question, a monstrous question that we haven't been able to answer nearly a century later. But now my fellow particle physicists, because when I went to Cornell, my intention was to go into particle physics, to study subatomic particles. I ended up going into physics, math, and astronomy because I became interested in galaxies. But my fellow particle physicists will say, well, let's see, what could dark matter be? Well, it's obviously something that does not either reflect light or generate light. In other words, it's a dark, non-luminous form of matter. It's like a different kind of matter than we've ever encountered before. And there are all these theories, you know, because this is what keeps scientists in business. They start brainstorming, spitballing all these explanations for this huge mystery, and one of them is called WIMPs, weakly interacting massive particles. And the idea is they're weakly interacting. In other words, they don't interact with the environment. That's why we can't see them. They're very stealthy. It's like the stealth bomber. They don't interact with the environment. So they're weakly interacting. And they're massive particles because we need them to be massive to drive that extra spin. Well, what have I just explained? Nothing. I've just come up with a different name for it. Instead of calling it dunkel materie or dark matter, now I call it WIMPs. And we have absolutely no clue. We've never seen a WIMP before. We have no idea really what a WIMP is. So this is what happens in science. It's like when you see the sausage being made, it's rather disillusioning.
Yeah, and to claim that it's weakly interacting, I mean, that's like it's weakly interacting with our sensory equipment. We don't see it because it doesn't interact with our how we observe the matter around it. But I mean, who knows? Maybe there's like when we think about the animal kingdom, there's this host of different sensory inputs that we all have. Like we don't see infrared, though some animals do. Like maybe we're just not looking with the right type of, like our eye isn't set up because we didn't need it. Like we didn't need to be able to see dark matter to survive as a species. So maybe we just didn't develop that. But maybe there's entities out there in the universe that, you know, it looks pretty thick to them because they need it to be. Maybe that's what they move through, or like maybe it gives them a structure that they need to function, where our function is not reliant on that. Who knows?
I think you make an important point, and you said something there that I want to return to about our sensory organs. You know, when I was a kid growing up with these three mottos of mine, the first one being, if I can't see it, I can't believe it. In retrospect, that's an awfully conceited point of view, isn't it? Because what you're the assumption buried deep within that motto is that somehow the human eye ought to be able to see everything that's out there. I mean, who said so? I mean, if you even believe in evolutionary biology, we evolved on the Earth. We didn't evolve in the universe. We evolved on the Earth. So what would make you think that a creature who evolves on the Earth would have the physical sensory capabilities to observe what's 93 billion or, you know, 40 billion light years away? What would make you think that? And it's just a conceit. There is no reason you should think that. So yeah, that's why when I got to grad school and all of a sudden I was told, or I learned from my various professors that not only is there dark matter, but there's dark energy. And when you add up the amount of dark energy and dark matter, it turns out that they make up 95% of the observable universe. And then beyond the observable universe, there's a universe we can't observe at all, 100% invisible to us. So think of our situation now. Here I'm this kid. If I can't see it, I don't believe it. Well, then you can't see 95% of the observable universe, and you can't see 100% of the universe beyond that. So what kind of life are you making for yourself? You're going to be, you're like deaf, dumb, and blind to most of what's out there. And that was the shock that hit me as a grad student when I realized that, when I realized that so much of reality is invisible to us. I mean, and not only invisible, I mean, we are like clueless. Like with dark matter, we're just as clueless about dark energy. It's some kind of a repulsive form of energy. It apparently is an aspect of empty space, but we don't know. I mean, I'm just speculating. We don't know what is causing the universe to accelerate, except that it's some kind of anti-gravitational force or energy. It's some kind of repulsive energy. Again, we just put a placeholder. Let's call it dark energy. Okay, I get a Nobel Prize. The three guys who saw in 1998, I covered the story for ABC News because I was science editor at ABC News at the time. And I covered that story. 1998, they discover the evidence for dark energy, and they go on and get the Nobel Prize. Well, they deserve the Nobel Prize for noticing that the universe is accelerating. But here again, you answer one question. The universe is not merely expanding, it's accelerating. Fantastic. You have just given us an important data point. But in the process, you have raised this huge question. What's driving the acceleration? You give it a name, but you don't have a clue about what it is. And that kind of is the story of science. And that's why that third motto of mine, that science would be able to answer all my questions, is bogus. It's just never going to happen. You know, Les, I think of it, you know, like if you lose a coin between cushions, if you're sitting on a sofa and a coin goes down between cushions and you go for it, you start, and the coin just keeps getting away from you. The further down you wedge your hand into the cushions, right, the coin is always just a little further away, and you just can't get a hold of it. That's kind of the process of science right now. We just can't, the more we probe the universe, the more we interrogate the universe, the more mysterious it comes, not the less mysterious. Some people might have said 200, 300 years ago, hey, give science enough time and it will demystify the universe. Well, that ain't the way the story has turned out. Just
well,
the
it's still early in the timeline. I mean, there's some component that's like, yeah, the fish is never going to be able to explain what water is. So, like, we're stuck in it, and how are we ever going to be able to objectively see from outside? I mean, for all we know, there's an oscillating process going on where, yeah, it's expanding until there's so much mass that it collapses, and it collapses down to a point, and then it repeats, and it's just some infinite, no beginning, no ending, like expansion and contraction. Or maybe that's going on, and it's going on a million other places too. Like, I'm not convinced that we even understand what gravity is. I mean, I've heard people describe gravity as like almost an emergent property, as a product of the relationship of space and time, almost like it's a byproduct. And it breaks my brain a little bit. I surely can't explain how other people would explain it, but I just think, like, you're right. There's a lot more that we don't know than we do. And we are an arrogant species. And, you know, that arrogance has probably served us really well. Like, the ego, whether it's individual or collective between our species, has probably got a lot of shit done and made a lot of advancements and made life better for a lot of people. It's also, like, created wars and all kinds of evil stuff. But, I mean, that's the reality we're in right now, it seems. You know, it's interesting, like, there's all these different religions out there, and I can't say that they all say this, but I know to some extent they believe that theirs is some, like, absolute truth. And I'm always, like, you know, I'm always wary when I hear someone talk like they know something. I feel like, how does it put, knowledge is the biggest obstacle to understanding, if you will. But there's something that's shared, that there is something. And I remember, I don't really consider myself a religious person, but I'm super curious about it all. And I've broken my brain through meditation, just trying to think about what's driving everything. Like, when I learn about matter and atoms, and as you get smaller and smaller, everything seems to be mostly nothing. Objects that are filled with mostly space with little particles, and then you blow up those particles and they're mostly nothing in space, and then they have even tinier particles, and these particles are being interchanged. Like, I have a wooden table right now at my desk that I would think that I have carbon atoms in my body that are being, like, you know, going back and forth, and at some point in time they're the table. At some point, they're timed me. And it's like, well, where is the information that determines whether this atom of carbon or molecule of something is my arm or that table? Right. You know, like, what kind of quantum soup is going on here that we see these edges, so we believe these boundaries between us and other objects or whatever, but, you know, if you had a different set of eyes, it would just be, if you had eyes that just saw quantum physics or whatever, it would be a bunch of mush of particles bouncing around. And so it's like, to me, whatever that energy is, or even better, whatever information is informing that energy to show up as it does, if I were to, like, point to something that represents what I feel like God is, it's like that. It's whatever that thing is that's informing it. Now, I know religions will have their different take, and I don't know, and maybe one of those are absolutely true. I don't know, but it does surely seem that, like the stories you make about all these things you said around dark matter, dark energy, could really dictate how you show up in the world. Like you could use it to be like, oh, we're so minute in the world, in the universe, nothing matters. So who gives a shit? I'll do whatever with my life. Or you could say, or you could use the same material to create the flip side of a different narrative and make yourself thinking it's amazing and you're in awe in every moment and you want to get the most out of life. And I feel like something that's shared between all these religions that seems to be at the very least useful is that they have the chance to like make you make life better by whether something's true or not, like to believe that there's something miraculous going on and we happen to be in the mix as part of it at some level.
Yeah, I like the way you think, and you're going to love the movie, I think, because you're to me the perfect viewer. That, you know, you haven't settled your mind about anything, but you're open. You're seeking. You're interested in knowing what's true, what's reliable. I'm the same way. That's the way I've always been in my life. I'm not 20 something anymore, but I'm still just as curious as I was when I was that age.
At the Mindful Movement Podcast, we talk a lot about the small shifts that make a big difference. And lighting, it's one of the most overlooked pieces of your well-being. That's why we're excited to share Chromalux light bulbs from healthlighting.com. These aren't your average light bulbs. Chromalux lights are designed to support your natural rhythms, reducing unnatural light spectrums and supporting a more balanced environment that feels better for your eyes and your mind. The difference is not just seen, but felt. Whether you're curating your workspace, winding down in the evening, or just trying to make your home feel a little more peaceful, the right light matters. Sarah and I have been steadily making the switch throughout our home, and its impact really makes a difference. It's honestly kind of hard to explain, but the space has become noticeably more inviting. If you are ready to bring more intention into your environment, head to healthlighting.com. and explore Chromalux bulbs. And as a part of our mindful community, you can get a special discount. Just use code MINDFULMOVEMENT at checkout. Light your space, support your mind, and keep on moving. If you've been listening to this podcast for a while, you've probably heard me talk about how important it is to regulate your nervous system. This goes for healing, for focus, for just overall emotional well-being. But the reality is that even if we know the tools to help do this, whether it's breathing or meditation or just slowing down, it can still be really hard to stay regulated throughout a busy day. That's one reason I've really been interested in the Apollo wearable by Apollo Neuro. Sarah and I both use this device regularly and have found it very beneficial. It's a small wearable device that uses gentle vibrations, and they're designed to signal safety to your nervous system. What's fascinating is that those signals can help your body shift out of a stress state and into a calmer, more regulated state. What I like about it, most of all, is that even though it can work great alongside practices like meditation or breath work, the real value is that you can wear it throughout your day, even while you're at work, and just let it work its magic on your nervous system. The other standout use that I rely on is wearing it to bed. Not only does it help me fall asleep fast, but I often wake up around 3 a.m. and I can just tap the button on it and it will help lull me back to sleep quickly. If you want to learn more, check out the podcast episode with the founder, David Rabin, and you could explore more about the technology itself. But if you're someone that struggles with anxiety or feeling wired or overwhelmed, or you're simply looking for more nervous system support in daily life, it might be something worth exploring. You can learn more about the Apollo wearable and how it works and save $99 on a new device at apolloneuro.com/mindful or click the link in the show notes. I promise you won't regret this investment. I truly believe it's the best bang for the buck in the wellness tech space.
You've said a number of things that I'd love to address, Les. I think everything coming out of your mouth is very thoughtful. And I really enjoy having a thoughtful conversation with somebody like yourself.
Thanks. Likewise, I enjoy talking to you.
Thank you, Les. When you try to explain how something could have come from nothing, it's really many of the origin problems that we have boil down to that. You start with a blank slate. How does it become full of either full of a universe or full of life? And So that concept is called abiogenesis, as you probably know, the idea that something can come from nothing. How do you explain that? And what has, especially more recently, because we live in the so-called information age, people have now begun to realize what you said so eloquently, which is that you have a universe that is ruled over by the second law of thermodynamics, right? That says entropy or disorder or chaos will either maintain itself or it will get worse. It will never get better on its own. So you're basically looking at a universe that is, its DNA is chaotic. And yet, that's not the end of the story. It's like the old guy, Paul Harvey, remember, the rest of the story. the rest of the story is that juxtaposed with this universe that appears to be wired for chaos, that's its predilection. That's what it wants to be. It wants to be chaotic. It takes an effort to make it unchaotic. It takes information. It takes information that will organize, take that chaos and organize it into something well-organized, constructed, what we call life. We are well-organized entities that defy the second law of thermodynamics. And the question is, how does that happen? Where is the information coming from? What's the origin of that information? If you're living in a universe that's wired for chaos, where does this external source of information come from? It has to be external, right? It's not internal. It's external. It's imposing its will on this chaotic universe, this universe that wishes to be chaotic more and more and more and more, left to its own devices. And, of course, that was one of the things that really caused me to take a leap of faith. And it's a leap of faith. It's not. I never reached a point in my life where I could prove that God exists or that, you know, Jesus is God and all the rest of it. But I got to the point where the evidence was just so compelling. It almost required a certain stubbornness or a certain agenda not to kind of surrender to the implications of the scientific evidence. And so as a Christian and as a scientist, you know, I see as a scientist, I would say, okay, there's an external source of information. Leave it at that. Don't name it. Don't spin it. Don't embellish on it. It's an external source of information. I'll leave it to you to figure out what that is. As a Christian, I believe, obviously, that's God. That's the creator of the universe. He's not within the universe. He is external to the universe. He created time and space and gravity. The other thing you mentioned was about the Big Bounce theory, where, and this has been around for as long as I've been alive, that, you know, perhaps the universe is just bouncing in and out, in and out, in and out. But when you look at especially the isotopes of helium and hydrogen, there are technical reasons we can't get into here, that kind of argue against that kind of big bounce theory. Here's the bottom line, and it's interesting to me as a cosmologist, because that's what I ended up specializing in. My thesis was in cosmology, the study of the origin and the development of the universe. And what I found interesting is that the crisis that we're in, the headline that I'm about to elaborate on, Les, is that we're in a cosmological crisis. Why? You already hinted at it in some of the things you said. The cosmological crisis is this. We have the general theory of relativity on the one hand, which purports to explain gravity. It explains it geometrically. It turns gravity into a geometry, not a field. Up until then, we thought of gravity as being a field, like a magnetic field. Einstein said, "No, you're thinking about it all wrong. You should think of it as just simply a force of some sort that is warping space and time." So he turned it into a problem of geometry, not of field. On the other hand, you have quantum mechanics, which has been validated over and over and over and over again. General relativity itself has been validated many times over in many different ways. The problem is the two theories don't jive. They're in conflict with one another. And the reason that's important to us cosmologists is because if indeed the universe is expanding, never mind whether it's bouncing in and out, in and out, in and out. Right now it's expanding, it's accelerating. The implication is that at some point, if you turn the clock backwards, it was in a hot, dense state. How do you explain that? In a hot, dense state, then, the universe, which is a large thing that comes under the authority of general relativity, now all of a sudden comes under the authority of quantum mechanics because it's in a hot, dense state. So how do you transition, from a scientist's point of view, how do you explain the transition or the development of something that starts in a hot, dense state and then turns into this incredible cosmologically scaled universe? Well, you start off with quantum mechanics, but you can never integrate that with gravity, with general relativity. They're fundamentally at odds with one another.
And yeah, so something's like if something's like absolutely true, it should make the world make sense regardless of where you're looking from.
Yeah, exactly. So this is the problem. And, you know, string theory came out in the 70s, created quite a little commotion. String theory is interesting, but it's a dead end. It goes nowhere. Again, it resolves to some degree, or it purports to resolve this conflict. You know, if you're doing plumbing, and you've got a half inch pipe here, but you've got a 1 inch pipe here, and you've got to marry the two together. You need an adapter, right? You need an adapter that takes the half inch to the 1 inch, right? And that's what we need right now. We have general relativity and we have quantum mechanics. We need some kind of an adapter that marries the two. String theory announced itself to be that adapter. They said, no problem, folks. Take a deep breath. We figured it out. We know how to reconcile general relativity to quantum mechanics.
Or the we just need something theory, that shows that when you look through this lens, neither of these make sense, but it makes everything make sense.
Yeah. But the problem with string theory is it just, again, raises a million other questions, and there's no evidence for string theory. We've done experiments. There's just zero evidence for it. So it's like the multiverse. The multiverse is yet another attempt, kind of a desperate attempt, to wiggle out of this cosmological crisis. And no matter how hard we try, I mean, Einstein himself, you know, one of the biggest scientific brains of the 20th century, he spent the last like 30, 40 years of his life trying to unify these disparate theories, and he couldn't even do it. I mean, he died a very frustrated old man. He hated quantum mechanics. You know, he says God doesn't throw dice. You know, he couldn't wrap his brain, as big as his brain was, he could not wrap his brain around a scientific theory that was founded on probabilities. It's got to be strict. I don't like probabilities. It's too fuzzy. It's too woo-woo. Well,
it's hard for me to imagine that we as humans will live long enough and exist long enough to answer some of these questions.
I think for sure. Yeah, I agree with you. I know. Look, I'm in the fourth quarter of my life left. Less, I ain't going to see the. I'm going to go out with let me put it this way. I'm going to go out with more questions on my lips than I had when I was a second grader in Los Angeles.
Mike, can I ask how old are you?
I don't want to say. No, I'm forever 21. But you know, I'm old enough that. I think what happens is...
But you're still young enough to make a movie on a computer all by yourself.
Yeah, and you know what? And I'm glad you said it because, you know, I have a Gen Z son. And, you know, to my Gen Z son, oh, Dad, you're old. I said, well, son, I mean, you know, but he knows I'm full of energy. I'm in good health. I'm full of energy.
You're fighting entropy, man, and loading it up with information and energy.
And, you know, conversations like this actually keep me young. They do. But what I want to say is, I'm glad you bring that up because, and I mean this seriously, I started making this movie in late February of last year. And it took me solid year to make it. Okay, people think, people have the misimpression that somehow AI makes everything easy. Like all you got to do is type in a prompt and you're good to go. No, it's not that easy at all. I mean, I had to, there's so much work in getting to know how to communicate with AI to get what you want, to get it to catch your vision for this movie. Then I had the music and special effects and titling.
I tried to make a 30-second advertisement. I gave up. I just couldn't. Yeah. Couldn't do it.
Yeah.
So I would like to hear a little bit more about that process. I mean, did you use one of the like common LLMs that we're familiar with, like the Claudes or the Chats? Like, what did you use to do this?
A year ago, I'm so glad you asked me that. A year ago, really, there was one video generator, AI video generator. That was called Runway, and that's in. It doesn't. It's like its own independent thing. It's not affiliated with Musk or OpenAI or anything like that. It was just its own thing, Runway. And honestly, I was thinking I was going to make this movie in the traditional way. It's like, okay, rinse and repeat. Let's do it again. And but I ran across this for just surfing the internet. And I saw Runway. What is this? AI video generators? It was, believe it or not, just a year ago, it was like a novelty. That's how far we've come in just 1 year.
That's
less.
Crazy.
It blows my mind. But I looked at it and I'm like, wow, you mean I just prompt? And so what I took, I had already written my script. So I took a line from my script and I put it in as a prompt. And I just said, what the heck? Let me just see what this thing does or doesn't do. And what it spit out, you know, wasn't exactly what I would have wanted or expected, but it was interesting enough that it caught my attention. I'm thinking, ooh, that's interesting. And so I tried it again and again, and about 15 times, after doing it 15 times, it gave me a result that just blew me away. It like blew my mind. It took my vision and took it to the next level. And so I thought to myself, I wonder, man, can I make a movie? I mean, a full-length motion picture, 5 seconds at a time? Because that's all it would spit out. It would spit out five. Now they can spit out 8 seconds, 10 seconds. Sometimes you can extend it a little further. But it's a laborious process. So I just kept at it. But I'm telling you, man, last summer, I didn't see the light of day. I had my shade down. I was closeted away here, just working 12-hour days. I was kind of reverting to my scientific monk days. I told my wife, Laurel, I said, man, I feel like I'm reverting to my scientific monk days back at Cornell when I was like holed up in my lab for 21 hours a day, except I couldn't do 21 hours. I couldn't do that anymore. I was young back then. I'm not that young. But she would feed me. She would be like, are you okay? I said, yeah. Just, yeah, I'm in the middle of it. Yeah, okay, well, eat. And I'm like, I eat, you know, and I literally sit at this desk that I'm talking to you from. And the computer you can't see is just off to my left right here. I started doing, and then my computer started crashing on me, Les, because it was just a word processing computer. It was like a Lenovo or something like that. Mm.
Just outmatched.
So I thought, oh my God, if I'm going to do this, I mean, these are huge files. These are MP4 files that this thing is generating. And so I was a minute into the movie and I'm like, the thing was already crashing on me. So I had to go on Best Buy and I found this gaming computer for like $2,000. I got it at Best Buy. And then I got myself a big old monitor because I just, you know, I was going to be staring at this thing for at least 12 hours a day. And that's how I made the movie. I just plugged away. And it was interesting, a guy posted something on X. I guess he saw a post about my movie. And I looked into him. He's this big guy in Hollywood who now runs a studio with just AI-generated studios. I mean, he's a big deal. And he said to me, man, on this X post, he said, that must have taken some perseverance for you to do a full-length motion picture. And I'm like, yeah. I mean, people will do, like you say, a minute. They'll do 10-minute short films. But my movie is an hour and 20 minutes.
Yeah,
that is
a
huge amount of work. And by the way, all my friends in Hollywood and even all the major chatbots, ChatGPT, Grok, and Gemini, I asked them, I said, has anybody done this before? And they all say, no, you're like the first. You're like the first guy whoever made a full-length motion picture on his desktop using consumer-level AI tools. So in the course of the year, I started with OneRay, then Kling, and then Sora came out, and I noticed OpenAI is discontinuing Sora. And then more recently, you know, Grok Musk came out with his X Imagine. I like Google Gemini right now. I think it's producing the biggest, best product. But then there's something called Whisk and Flow and Midjourney. So I have like three dozen apps that I use for sound, for imagery, for animating still photographs. I mean, it's like it's fascinating. And
they work together, like they you could just it just adds the work from one can be integrated into the work from the other.
If you use an AI editor, which I did.
Gotcha.
So I actually use three, maybe four editors. One is CyberLink PowerDirector 365. Another one is Adobe Premiere Pro. And another one is called Wondershare of Filmora. But then there's also DaVinci Resolve done by Blackmagic. So, right. And what you do is, let's say you go to Runway and you say, okay, I need teenagers jumping off a cliff into deep water, right? I just wanted to have a scene where teenagers were just, you know, having a good time. It just couldn't do it. And, you know, the teenagers would jump off, but then it would they would start floating, or they would sprout an extra arm or an extra leg or an extra... And I'm like, ah! And so what I learned less in this process was that certain AI generators are better than others at doing certain things. So now I know enough that, okay, if I need to have a scene of a kid riding a bicycle in a neighborhood, I know which app to go to, because I know certain apps are better with physics than others, right?
Yeah, I remember.
Others are better at human beings. So it was a learning process. And, you know, like I tell my boy, I said, well, son, your old dad, like you were saying, I'm nobody special. I didn't know anything about AI, and yet I made an entire full-length motion picture on my desktop using a Best Buy gaming computer.
Right? Yeah, it's crazy.
Right?
I mean, there's probably people doing it right now. I mean, there's movies being made now by kids all over, probably. I remember when I tried to make, kept running into this issue where, like, the character from the first clip, by the time you worked on the second clip, like they would have different outfit on or something. Like I couldn't just maintain consistency and I got too frustrated and gave up. But now, like, I watched a video just the other day of a woman that was a YouTube content creator that provides different services. I think they're like kind of business growth type services, but she like cloned herself. And her story was like, she got sick and like basically couldn't make content. So she used one of these AI app things to clone herself and just put out content for her. And then she wound up creating another AI agent to basically clone her business. So now it's like infinitely scalable. And it's hard to imagine the world's coming up. Like, I would like to do a podcast with somebody that's like doesn't exist anymore, you know? And I think you can do that. You know, I want to interview the Albert Einstein.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah. Well, you know what? You can interview me after I die. I'll tell you what. Yeah. Okay. What you're talking about is absolutely true. There is a program called HeyGen, but there are others also.
Yeah, that was one of them that was mentioned. HeyGen. Yeah.
Yeah. HeyGen will allow you to, and I did it. I cloned myself. All you have to do is like feed it, like, the more the better, but they recommend that you feed it at least like 10 minutes, 15 minutes of you talking to camera. Okay. And then it ingests that video and then takes a day or two and it basically digitizes you. So now what you can do, you have your avatar, you have your AI avatar, your AI clone. It's stored in the computer at HeyGen. Now you can type out what you want your avatar to say. And then again, you marry that, you ingest that script into HeyGen, and a few minutes later, it says your file is ready, and there you are, your clone saying the things that you want. And even in just the last year less, the emotion has increased. Because early on, it would be like, hello, Les, it's good to be on your podcast. Thank you for inviting me. You know, and just kind of stiff and wooden, not really. But now it's like, hey, Les, thanks a lot. You know, you can do upper body motion, head smiling. You can even make myself chuckle. I mean, it is crazy. And the problem that you encountered, that's being overcome by what we call a reference image. You ingest a reference image. And so anything you generate after that will use that reference image. You can get it to say or do or be clothed in any way you want. And this is just in a year, man. You're talking, what are we, just April, barely April.
So where does it go? Like, well, let me ask you this. Where do you see the problems are? I mean, I see problems with like deep fake stuff around elections and things like that. But is there anything that you think about where you, like, if we don't figure this out as humans, we're going to have a real problem on our hands?
Yes, I do. I mean, with any technology, there's a downside. You know, nuclear, we can build a bomb or we can do nuclear medicine. It kept my mom alive, you know, for years after she was diagnosed with breast cancer. Same with AI. I mean, it's, you know, it's killing jobs, entire sectors. I mean, there, for example, AI now was put into competition with radiologists who read x-rays and CAT scans and all the rest of it. And AI actually rates better than, you know, a 20-year veteran radiologist. And radiologists are overworked. There's a shortage of radiologists. People may not realize that. So that's both good and bad. It's competing against human radiologists, but at the same time, it's filling a gap. In Japan, they have a big problem with caretakers because their population is aging. It's a very old population in Japan. They're not procreating. And so there's a huge shortage of caretakers. Japan is actually leading the way in terms of creating these robots that are programmed with these very emotive programs, with these emotive AI programs. Again, good and bad. Yeah, it's killing jobs, but it's creating jobs as well, new jobs. Look, I was talking to a church the other day. I was talking to this man, and I said, well, what do you do? He says, well, I'm a building maintenance guy. So, you know, he like fixes things. He's a Mr. Fix-It. And I said to him, well, you know what? I said, you have nothing to worry about from AI. You're going to be like the last person to be replaced because AI is not going to come and fix your faucet. It ain't going to come and, you know, unplug your toilet. But if you're an accountant or, like I say, a radiologist, it's coming after you. So it will kill jobs.
I talked to somebody recently who runs an engineering firm that does design for like big commercial stuff and super high end residential stuff, you know, $40 million houses, or whatever.
Yeah.
But, and so convinced that AI can't take their jobs. And I'm like, that is naive. I'm thinking where my mind goes is an AI system. Could, first of all, you could say, you know, who your favorite architects are or whatever to inform the type of development you want to build. Say, well, these are my favorites, so blend them. I like this aspect of this architect and this, and I want you to make 100 drawings of a building, of a structure that all meet code to every state, whatever. And like, and then it could give you 100 and then say, well, I like these 10. So these are the ones I like the best. Now make 10 more based on these. And what I see happening is eventually the insurance companies, like her take is you're going to need a human to stamp, a human architect to stamp it. And I'm like, no. The insurance company is going to charge you more if you have a human stamping it. They're going to eventually trust the AI system, and that's going to lower their risk exposure because they're going to be better at it. Just like with driving, I heard there's already companies that are offering lower insurance if you're using self-driving on a Tesla because it's better than the human.
Yeah, it's got a better accident
rate. It's coming
rate.
For everything. And yeah, maybe the janitor or the plumber, it'll take longer.
I think the tradespeople are the last ones that are going to get replaced, honestly. But I mean, I just read a story that Mark Zuckerberg is creating a CEO avatar that, I mean, he's literally grooming his, that he he is created a digital CEO that he consults. So he's like a co-CEO at Meta, right? Also, I mean, exactly. Why not? When it comes to design, my wife slaves over doing the taxes every year. I see her with the files and the folders and the boop, but a pop, but a boop, but a peep. And I told her, Laurel, I said, a year or two from now, if it's not already the case, I said, an AI program will take over this thing. It'll do beautiful. It'll just keep track of your expenditures and your income. And at the end of the year, you just boop, push a button and it'll spit out, fully filled out the IRS form. That's all you need to do. That is the perfect stuff for AI to take over. Now, the good news, and I wrote actually a Substack essay about this a couple of months ago. I said the very good news about AI. And I think just to summarize it, I invite you to go see it. My Substack, by the way, is called morethanmeetstheiq.com. Morethanmeetstheiq.com. Don't you just love that name? I was proud of myself when I came up with that. Morethanmeetstheiq.com. Anyway, so I did this thing, the very good news, something like the very good news about AI. And the gist of the essay was, look, yeah, just get used to it. AI is going to take over certain jobs and they're going to do a better job than you can. But there are things that AI will never be able to replace you with. And it's because we are not just physical creatures. We're not just drudges doing drudge work. We are spiritual creatures capable of a certain kind of wisdom that no computer will ever be able to have. The other day, I was working on a project with Gemini. I like Gemini, Google Gemini right now. To me, it's the cat's meow. So I was saying to him, I said, well, look, I just wrote this. Take a look at it. Give me what you think. You know, critique it for me. And its response was very, very interesting. He said, well, you know, Dr. G, as an AI, I don't have a soul. I don't have a spirit. So I can't really give you an honest opinion. I just found that very interesting that there was that kind of self-awareness in AI, even today in 2026, that it recognizes its own shortcomings. And I wonder, there might be 100 years from now where, you know, maybe as you said earlier about gravity possibly being an emergent, maybe soulfulness, maybe spirituality is an emergent property. There are some people who believe that. Like Dan Brown, who wrote that book, The Da Vinci Code, and others, they believe that as computers get more and more complex, they become smarter and smarter. Sooner or later, will emerge from that complexity a kind of spirituality. I don't believe it. There's no evidence for that. But he's entitled to his opinion.
Who knows? I mean, they're inserting technology into humans to get the benefits of that. But who's asking the question of, can we take a robot and take something from our heart or our brain and put it in it? Can we take that part of us and integrate it into the machine as opposed to the other way around?
Then that becomes something different, right? That becomes a cyborg. And I have written about cyborgs and the whole transhumanism. You know, there's a whole transhumanism movement where, you know, the idea is you can enhance yourself with technology. I mean, to some degree, Musk is doing that with Neuralink, right?
Right.
Musk is implanting chips in people's brains and they're able to do things they couldn't normally. I think it's fantastic. It gives, you know, people their mobility back. I think that's fantastic. But what you're saying, yeah, that's entirely possible. And there are experiments going on at MIT and elsewhere where they are trying to fuse together biological and silicon-based circuitry. In other words, can you fuse the two together to create some hybrid that does have some semblance? I won't go so far as to say it has a spirituality, because as a Christian, I believe that our spirit is breathed into us by God. So if we create something in the lab, I don't think it's going to have our same kind of spirituality. But it may have a facsimile of it. Or maybe somebody might argue, well, Gillen, the spirituality that God breathed into you, his spirit that he breathed into you, is in every cell of your body. It's in every embedded in your DNA. So if you fuse your DNA with a piece of silicon circuitry, it will have your spirit. That's an interesting argument. I mean, but
it's a reasonable idea.
Yeah.
You know, we say things aren't natural, but if we're natural and we're making them, who says they're not natural? I mean,
yeah.
And who says, like you said, the breath of Jesus or God, why would that not transfer downstream? Who knows? Look, I've kept you longer than you had time, and I'm recognizing that, and I apologize. Dr. G, this has been great. I've really enjoyed the conversation. Invisible Everywhere, Believing is Seeing. Repeat again. Where do they go to see it?
They're real simple. You go to theinvisibleeverywhere.com, theinvisibleeverywhere.com. Come April 8th, you'll get to see the movie. Right now, if you go, you can see the trailer. But it's that simple. Wherever you are, whoever you are, whatever you believe, whatever you don't believe, just go to theinvisibleeverywhere.com on April 8th, and you'll get to see the movie. And let me know what you think when you see it. Les, I've really loved it. I can look, I'm doing a lot of media right now, as you can imagine. There's a lot of interest internationally, a lot of interest in this movie. But I got to say to you, you're like, in my mind, the perfect host. You're a thoughtful person. I really respect your mind. And I really want to thank you for giving me this time to talk about something that I really love. This movie does not preach. Don't worry about it. It just simply chronicles my journey of how science shattered my atheism. And I think hopefully my journey can, at the very least, leave you with a deeper appreciation for the profound mystery of the universe out there and the profound universe in here. Because we not only inhabit a deeply mysterious, mostly invisible universe, but we are inhabited by a deeply mysterious, mostly invisible universe. So that, if you can only just take that away from the movie, I think you'll enjoy it. It will be worth the price of admission. But thank you, Les. I really appreciate it. I enjoyed this a lot.
Sounds great. Well, I appreciate the kind words also. And for the listeners, always grateful for your listening. I hope you also enjoyed the conversation. I hope you'll share it with somebody that you care about. And if you have something to add, please comment. And I look forward to those comments. And I will get back to everyone I can. Enjoy your day, everybody. Take care.